Shankaracharya states that the theory of transformation presented in the Vedanta Sutra implies that the absolute truth itself is transformed. In this way, the Mayavadi philosophers denigrate Srila Vyasadeva by accusing him of an error. They thus find fault in the Vedanta Sutra and misinterpret it to try to establish the theory of illusion. Purport. You can roll down for the purport. Thank you. Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The first verse of the Brahma Samhita, of the Brahma Sutra is the Tattva Brahma Jigasa. We must now inquire into the absolute truth. The second verse immediately answers Janmadyasya Yata. The absolute truth is the original source of everything. Janmadyasya Yata does not suggest that the original person has been transformed. Rather, it clearly indicates that he produces this cosmic manifestation through his inconceivable energy. This is also clearly explained in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, Mata sarvam prabhachate, from me everything emanates. Next one. This is the continued purport?
Yes, this is the continuation. It's three slides because it's a long purport, so it was divided.
This is also confirmed in the Tattariya Upanishad 3.1.1, Yato Ve Immani Bhutani Yajayanti. The supreme absolute truth is that from which everything is born. Similarly, in the Mukanda Upanishad 1.1.7, it is stated, Yato Na Yabhi Sri Jati Grinati Cha. The Lord creates and destroys the cosmic manifestation, as a spider creates a web and draws it back within itself. All of these Shastric statements indicate the transformation of the Lord's energy, not of the Lord himself. Transformation of the Lord's energy is called Parinatavad, Parinamavad. However, being very anxious to protect Srila Vyasadeva from criticism, Shankaracharya became a pseudo-gentleman and put forward his theory of illusion, Vivartavad. Shankaracharya concocted this meaning of Parinamavad, and by word jugglery, he endeavored very hard to establish Parinamavad as Vivartavad. Back to the verse again. Shankaracharya states that the theory of transformation presented in the Vedanta Sutra implies that the absolute truth itself is transformed. In this way, the Mayavadi philosophers denigrate Srila Vyasadeva by accusing him of error. They thus find fault in the Vedanta Sutra and misinterpret it to try to establish the theory of illusion. Om Magyana Tamundasya Ganandana Shalakaya Chakshu Shumilatam Jena Tasma Sivurve Namaha Sri Taitanya Mano Vishtam Stabitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupagadamayam Dhananti Swapadantakam Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhanityananda Sri Advaitigadar Ha Sivasan Gaur Bhakta Brinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to speak on this verse. I shall try my best to elucidate on the topic. Thanks to the Parampara, Srila, my own Shiksha Guru, Srila Guru, Srila Gauravinda Swami, and Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, Srila Gokushala Das Babaji Maharaj, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srila Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Maharaj, Srila Nathan Das Thakur, Srila Lokanath Swami, Krishnadas Gavra Maharaj, the six Goswamis. We come from a great lineage of great thinkers and teachers. So this is our gotra. This is our real line of ancestry. So any one of us who is sincere can link with all these acharyas. All their works are written for us to study, to learn from, and ultimately become devotees of Krishna. That is the goal, to become lovers of Krishna, Krishna Prema for deity. This is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come to offer. And ultimately, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said that it's very difficult to find bona fide guru in this Kali Yuga, but Mahaprabhu has come to act as guru. Raghavija Nija Bhakti Yoga Shikshashtameka Purusha Parayanaha Sri Krishna Te Tane Sri Radha Ne Kripabhu Ne Yastam Amma Bhajyante. We offer obeisances to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He has come to teach us what is devotion and what is not devotion. And specifically regarding my Bhava philosophy, he differs. He's dressed as a sannyasi. Vande Sri Krishna Chaitanya Nityananda Savanavano he mango vanga sanga nangani sanyat kichama shantra mishta shanti prayanaha. In the Mahabharata, this is a verse describing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He is very beautifully situated in his bodily makeup and constitution. He is covered with sandalwood pulp. And he differs from the Mayavad sannyasis because he preaches the glory of bhakti, devotion to Krishna. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he is assisted by Nityananda Prabhu. Vande Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Nityananda Sahodano, Gauradaya Vashpatram Choroi. So the moon and the sun have risen simultaneously on the eastern horizon of Gaudiya, and they have come to distribute this nectar of devotion to Krishna. So this is the business of the Hare Krishna movement. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he is teaching two things. He has internal life and his external teachings. And if we look at all the acharyas, the great acharyas in our line, they're generally like that. They have two purposes in their life. They have their own transcendental ecstasies, and they also preach Krishna consciousness. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu lived his life like that. It's the first part of his life, preaching extensively, touring, challenging impersonal philosophers and other bogus philosophies. And ultimately he went to Jagannath Puri to searching after himself, one of our acharyas. Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come searching after himself, in the sense that he wants to know the glories of Radharani's love. He wants to know what impact he makes on other people, his love, his beauty, his bliss. Because Jiva Goswami has explained in his Satsandhava, Vritti Sandhava, that Krishna is full of bliss. Ultimately, this is what the Mayavadis need to understand, Krishna's bliss. We know the impersonal Brahman, there is some bliss there, but then beyond is the rasa tattva, the relationships that one can have with another jiva. Actually, this is what everyone's looking for. And the impersonal philosophy does great discredit to the material world because people get turned off by it. They're in the material world, they're looking and having so many relationships in so many different ways. Why do they want to make it zero? Because of disappointment, they make it zero. They want to make it zero. And actually, Jiva Goswami also mentions in his Sandavas that impersonal philosophy is a bit like deep sleep. One of Prabhupada's godfathers was once giving a class, I was listening, and he was suggesting impersonal Brahman is like a deep sleep. And I was thinking, oh, why is he saying? That's a strange comparison. But then think about it, you can understand why he might say it. But later, reading Jiva Goswami's Sandavas, he said the same thing. And I thought, oh, that's where he got it from. Because supposing you have a very busy day and you have so many troublesome relationships, what do you want to do? You like to sleep. You just close your eyes and go. And in deep sleep, it is zero. There is nothing. But there is a sense of relief and happiness when you wake up, oh, I've had a very good deep sleep. But then if you have not got your situation to hand in your life and your relationships are troublesome, then it could be that you might be looking forward to your next deep sleep. So the Mayavadis are like that. They are disappointed in relationships. And that's all right. But then find the real solution. So in this class, we can examine a little of the conversation and the conclusions of Mahaprabhu's conversation with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. So Sankaracharya, he came, he has to do service to Krishna in the form of Lord Shiva. He's come to mislead people. We know that he did that for specific reasons, to because the Buddhists had taken their philosophy of zero, impersonal zero, make everything zero, as Prabhupada said, nirvana. So they became disgusted with the whole concept of violence in the scriptures, because people were misusing the Vedic literatures. And therefore the Buddha came to say to people, well, why is all this violence going on? And he introduced a new philosophy. So Shankaracharya came and he brought people back to the Vedas by twisting the meanings. We know the history. So the beauty of which is expressed in this particular chapter, where Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is meeting Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. During that chapter, the Atmarama verse is discussed, and there Krishna or Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he explains the Atmarama verse to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya in great detail. The essence of it is that Krishna, being full of qualities, he can attract, because Krishna means all attractive. So Krishna has the capability of attracting everyone. So he attracts the jnanis, he attracts the karmis, he attracts the yogis, and he also attracts the bhaktas. So this is very important. Because like we were saying earlier, the karmis, they're searching after rasa. They're looking for rasa, they're looking for happiness, they're looking for beauty. They're searching everywhere for it, in their families, in their relationships, in their workplace, in their arts. Everywhere you'll find, go to the theater. They're getting into emotions in so many deep ways. If you go to a opera house, you'll find these so-called upper classes, they study very deeply emotions and love. So they're looking for these things, and they know it exists. Why? It's inherent within the soul. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Subject of Anuraya Shravanada Shuri. This love of God is already there in the heart. It needs to be brought out. So there was a discussion regarding that matter. Well, what kind of love is in the heart? Because one could say, have we fallen from the spiritual world? There's that discussion is there, where we come from. So love, or pure love of Krishna, as exhibited by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the mood of Radharani, it is said that that has not been given before. So this love, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Subject, it is potential love is there. So by association of a devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu who has understood the essence of what Mahaprabhu is teaching, he then begins to further develop his potential to love Krishna in the fullest, because anandam buddhivadam, ever increasing, nothing is static in the spiritual world. Even Radharani's love and is ever increasing. This is the nature of love. It's never a static thing. You don't just love someone one day and you love someone the same way all the time. When you see your lover or your mother or whoever it is, your friend, every moment you see them is something new. We experience that all the time in our lives. What to speak of a transcendental personality like Krishna, who is far beyond the comprehension of us in terms of the depth of his personality and the depth of his capabilities of love. So Krishna, he is Rasaraj, he is searching after love. He is very attracted to that, just as we are. We are attracted to it because we are part and parcel of Krishna. We have seen similar qualities, but he has them in full. So this Atmarama verse explaining is Krishna is capable of attracting everyone, the Kamis, the Gyanis, the Yogis, and especially the Bhaktas. So we know the story of the four Kumaras. They were impersonalists as such, Brahman realized. But they became attracted when they smelt the tulsi offered at the lotus feet of Krishna. Sukadeva Goswami, he was also liberated, but yet he became attracted to the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is the beauty of Krishna. And the wondrous thing about Krishna is that once he is known, everything is known. That's a fact. If you know Krishna, you know everything, because Krishna is the source of everything. So now, we may not be trained as scientific thinkers ourselves. We may not be PhDs or even that well studied in science, but Prabhupada has said that we must understand Krishna scientifically. So as much as possible in our education, we must try to understand how is it that Krishna is manifesting his energies everywhere? How is it he has become transformed? And one point I will try to make in this discussion is that Krishna can be understood scientifically by his energies. And it's a very wonderful thing that even when Srila Prabhupada wrote these books, and when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta discussed his teachings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and our previous acharyas, they had understanding of Krishna in so many different ways. They understood that Krishna's energy transforms. But one advantage we have in this age which is a very wonderful thing, is that the modern scientists have done us a great service. Sometimes we condemn scientists, or well, some people do, they say they're rascals, but they are when they present their subjective opinions as facts instead of looking at the objective world around them. But they have done a great service to Krishna in the sense that we can now further study how Krishna is manifesting himself through the material world. Let's see a couple of things that Krishna himself says on the topic. I'll read a couple of verses. Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchitananda Vigraha Anadi Adi Govinda Sarvakarikaranam. Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the supreme controller. He is eternal, blissful, spiritual body. He is the origin of all. There's no other origin, for he is the cause of all causes. So this cause of all causes, the origin of all, everything you see around us, earth, water, air, fire, ether, mind, intelligence, everything, all the universes, Krishna is declaring, these all come from him. He's the cause of all this. And he also says, Maya Jakshina Bhakriti, Suyasi Sacharacharam, Hetanunina Kuntiya Jagat Vi Paripatite. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction. It is producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. Krishna also further says, Aham savasya paravo matta saram prabhatite iti matva vanatimam buddha bhava saman. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wives who know this perfectly engage in my devotional service. Another, in the Ishapanishad, Om Punaga Panamadam Punapanamadachite Punasya Panamadaya Punam Vashishishite. So Krishna again and again and again. And Arjuna declares in the Bhagavad Gita, after hearing from Krishna, Param Brahma Param Dhamma Pavitram Param Vam Purusham Shashvatam Jivam Adi Deva Vigam. So Krishna, so many places, he declares. Now we have to have faith what Krishna is saying. But we have limited senses. Tatsi Krishna Namandina Baba Gravindraya Seva Mukhi Hiji. We have very limited senses. We need our senses purified to thoroughly understand Krishna consciousness and our situation. Through bhakti mama vajavandi, Vasudeva Savam, you know, by doing bhakti to Krishna. Knowledge is revealed to the jiva automatically. At the same time, we can use our intelligence and see, well, how is it that Krishna is situated within the material world? How can that be? So as I was saying, fortunately, the scientists have helped us a great deal on these matters. So let's see a little bit about that. What I've made notes of here. For instance, if you look up energy transformation, we can see the scientists say energy transformation, also known as energy conservation, it is the process of changing energy from one form to another. In physics, energy is quantity that provides the capacity to perform work, or providing heat in addition to being converted. According to the law of conservation of energy, energy is transferable to a different location or object, but it cannot be created or destroyed. So that's what the Karmis or science will say about transformation of energy. And the interesting part here, we can see that energy is conserved. It is neither created nor destroyed. Well, the Vedas will agree with that. In the Bhagavad Gita, one of the five principles is matter. Matter is eternal. It is not that matter is destroyed. It is brought back inside Mahavishnu. So there is conservation of energy there. Energy is comes from Krishna, manifests for some time in various ways, and then brought back inside Krishna. So we would agree with this business of energies being not created nor destroyed. Rather, they are manifest for some period of time. They enact their business, like it says here, heat, light, or whatever. And then they are brought back inside or conserved within Krishna himself. So Krishna says in the 111 Srimad Bhagavatam, all pervading personality of Godhead, we obeisance to you, we obey on Krishna. He is the cause of all causes, of the creation, substance, and destruction of the manifest universes. He is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations. He is independent. There's no other cause beyond him. It is he only who first imparted the Vedic knowledge unto the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. By him, even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion, as well as bewildered by the illusory representations of water, steam, fire, lands, and water. It's only because in him that the material universe is temporarily manifested by the free motion nature appear factual, although they are unreal. So this Vedic knowledge was given to Brahma. Brahma is the chief engineer of this universe. And then he goes on to create the universes. He's situated within the universe, and then he has to create all the planets within it. At first, when he is first born, there is darkness. He's sitting alone on his lotus leaf, on his lotus flower, and there he's wondering, who am I? What am I? What is this? And then he begins to crawl down into the stem of the lotus flower. So he's searching, 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 just like us. We are also searching, who am I? What am I? What is life all about? So Brahma had the same experience. So he began to crawl down the origin of his flower. He crawled down the stem. So, and then he heard the words tapa being chanted, some transcendental sound vibration. So he was instructed to undergo meditation. So same with us in our lives. We have to undergo a search, searching, searching, searching. Our whole life should be like that. Not taken up with so much the objective world, more of a subjective world, the search within. Because actually by intelligently looking out into the material world, we can work out the nature of matter. Even the Vedas will tell us, our ancestors will tell us, our logic will tell us, and our experience will tell us four ways of understanding the temporary nature of this material world. So this is a thoughtful person. Most people, unfortunately, are kamis, in the sense that they are fruitive workers, very few gyanis. Especially in Kali Yuga, not so much gyanis in courage, really, in one sense, although you could say, well, there's lots of education going on in the world, and it's true, there is. What kind of education? Mostly it is subjective opinions presented as facts, specifically the works of Charles Darwin. Actually, Charles Darwin was one of the most influential people in modern times, when you think about it. The whole world has changed its approach because of his teachings. once one famous BBC news reporter called Andrew Marr, he said to Prince Philip that he thinks that Charles Darwin is one of the most Charles Darwin has changed life more than anyone else. And even Prince Philip looked at him and thought, I just don't like people who generalize. So that was quite intelligent of Prince Philip to make such a statement. But actually, Charles Darwin has made a lot of difference to people's lives, because now they're becoming convinced. And it's unfortunate, really, how that widespread philosophy of Darwinism is taught throughout universities. Even as a young child, you may remember looking at a picture of your history book of an ape turning into a man. Most unfortunate, even from very early age, you'll find these things being taught. And all the way up to university level, most of the even the university students are being taught by professors who don't really understand. Most of them don't really understand the chemistry or the physics or the biology behind Darwinism. It's mostly taught by people who have not really thoroughly understood all aspects of what they've been taught. A kind of an acceptance. So it's like that all over the world, actually, whether it be Shankaracharya's twisting the meaning of the Vedas or the teachings of Charles Darwin in the world, or let's take even the financial world, the stock market tradings, the fast technologies, the cryptocurrencies, the dark web and all the financial transactions that go on in the material world at very, 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 very fast speed, so fast that a microsecond later the share prices have crashed, or a microsecond later the share prices have boomed. It's all conducted by crooked people to twist truth and to manipulate truth according to what they want for their purposes. So this is going on. This is Maya. This is the material energy, and according to their karmic condition, they are given the intelligence. So Charles Darwin was given such great intelligence to come out with this. But it's not so... I don't know why people rave about it, really. I mean, I think we can accept that... transformation of energy in terms of, for instance, micro evolution, we can accept that. That there are some changes according to the place that we might live in. For instance, if we were living in the Highlands of Scotland and we were sheep, we'd have very thick woolly coats. And the winters are very hard there. So those sheep that have very thick woolly coats, they'll survive better, and they'll be able, their children and their further generations will do better than those with less woolly coats. This is called microevolution. That we can accept. But we don't accept Charles Darwin's theory of the little warm pond, that he once wrote a letter to his friends, and he wished for a little warm pond where transformation of energies can occur in such a way that some sludge at the bottom of the pond would react to some lightning and some heat, and some cells would begin, or some matter, some chemical evolution would happen where the elements and the compounds of chemistry combined together, and somehow or other life came. That we do not accept. And actually, abiogenesis is a topic which is worth studying. And many, many chemists today will assume that life comes from chemicals. You may have heard of Miller-Urey, the famous experiments that were carried out. And they ended up, after much ado, with some little sludge and some amino acids were there. And they thought, oh, this is the beginning of life, so here we have something which we could probably assume how, we can assume from this, this is probably how life came. But since 1953, when that experiment took place, to now in 2020, not much has happened. But when you consider it, how much has happened technologically from 1953 up to 2020, we have so much technology moved on in terms of computer and engineering and so on and so forth. But the Miller-Urey experiment, very little happened, to be honest. And the interesting part is that even though the Miller-Urey experiment came up with some sludge and some early forms of amino acid, if you were to examine life itself, when consciousness is involved in the production of chemicals and life. In other words, when consciousness enters, a selection process takes place. And I just cannot understand why it is that amino acids always choose, because amino acids are, they're like our hands. They have the left and right. What is it called? Chiral or something. I've got one of it now. Chirality. So your left hand and your right hand, they are chiral. There's a mirror image of itself. If you hold your right hand up at the mirror, you'll find you're seeing, you're looking at your left hand. Well, everything, elements and chemicals are like that. So when it comes to selecting life, amino acids, they're also chiral, but it's only the left hand part that's chosen for life. And when it comes to the sugars that are required for life, it's only the right hand part of the sugars that are selected for life. You can look into this on the internet. So this is very strange to the scientists and chemists of today's mystery, why life chooses the left and not the right. There has been some evidence of some scientists that look into mice brain, and they see some little traces of the right-hand amino acids in a mice brain. So they're thinking that there must be some purposes behind it, maybe something to do with psychology, I don't know. Same with DNA inside the body. The body is, this is another aspect of what I'm talking about here. Let me just get back to the point. I don't want to go too much off track. I'm trying to point out that when Krishna says he is everywhere, we can begin to see how it is it that Krishna is everywhere. By his intelligent arrangement, we will give the argument. For instance, let's take the A's, T's, and G's in the DNA. We see that code everywhere. So these codes are quite incredible. And they can transform in various ways, and they can produce various types of bodies. So wherever we see codes like that, and incidentally, Bill Gates, when he began to hear about the genome and the codes within it, which Francis Crick discovered and called the fingerprints of God, Bill Gates thought, well, this is very similar to a computer code. So it's very astute of him to think like that. The 1011000, whatever, breaking down a picture, transforming it, carrying it like the signal we're looking at now. It's breaking up this picture. It's transforming it for one zeros and sending it through the internet at very high speed. And you're seeing my picture at the other end. It's all coded information, binary codes. Well, DNA, AC's teaching G's are like that. So they have many, many capabilities. And this science, this is what I was saying earlier, how scientific thinkers have done a great favor to us, because this is how Krishna, when he says, this is how Krishna's everywhere. He's there by his intelligence, by his intelligent arrangements. That code, the A's, T's, and G's, comes from Krishna. Just as the 1010 comes from intelligence. We can't assume. When we see codes, we must assume there must be a conscious intelligence behind the codes that make sense. Because some of the scientists will say, no, these codes, they just interact by chance, and then they produce proteins, and the proteins happen by chance through mutations. They claim like that. But this is refuted, because everything is very precision made in producing proteins. If there is a slight error in the production line, the protein is not produced, and it is automatically scrapped. And that's a fact. It either corrects itself or it scraps itself. So each of us have around 50 trillion cells, that's 50 billion. If we took the DNA from all of these cells and laid it out in linear fashion, it could wrap around the Earth 2.5 million times. Or the scientists say it could reach the sun and back 300 times. So all this information is there within the cells and DNA. The random changes, if we ever make random changes to information, as the scientists might suggest, what would happen is the information degrades. Information degrades when you mess around with it. It has to be precise. So there's more ways for it to go wrong than right. So to come up with a functioning protein structure through a mutation process by chance. It's calculated by some scientists. But you'd have to make 10 to the power of 74. That's 10 with 74 zeros. That kind of statistics to get something happening by chance. Or we could consider that maybe 100 monkeys typing on 100 typewriters for 100 years might come up with a letter that we could read and make sense of. But the chances of that is impossible. So this is the kind of thing that the Darwinian, when they see these codes, this transformation of energy, which is Krishna's energies, when they see it working in such ways, they become very fearful, and they begin to think, "Wow, what is this? They must come up with something to counteract it." So their idea is the little warm pond and the chance mutations that cause life to vary in species. So their idea of life is that there was a little warm pond, one microbe, And from there, that mutated, and then this one mutated, and so on and so forth, until we come to explain all the species of life. But this is not acceptable by most intelligent scientists who look into the matter much in a very deep analytical way. They see there are some flaws in this thinking. There is a movement called the Intelligent Design Movement to study these things. There's one series recently, a 13-part series on abiogenesis by Professor James Torr, who's one of the leading chemists in the world, and he explains these things really well and refutes the speculations. Finally, I would say, because we're running out of time now, they say chance and accidentally. Prabhupada, I was listening to Prabhupada Morning Walk recently, and he said, this is nonsense. He said, why are you trying to become rich or educated? Why are you making the effort? Why do you not sit at home and by chance you may become rich or educated? So he said, no, everything's happening by five causes: the body, the performer, the senses, the endeavor, and ultimately the super soul. So it is actually the variety of life that we see all around us, the organization, it all comes about by the interaction of Krishna, and he's interacting with us because we have free will. So what we're looking at around us today is free will and determinism, because we are having so much capacity to act in so many ways. Krishna's facilitating that within the laws that he's already put in place. And then it has a deterministic nature because we have to face the consequences of our action. So Krishna's energies transform. We can talk about this for a long, long time, but basically, from our point of view today, we can think of it like that in modern scientific terms. The ACs, T's and G's, it's like a computer code. 101010, we see that, we have experience of it. We can also see that a very intelligent man, he's running his business empire, and through his energies, everything is carried on automatically, like this chap who runs Amazon. He sits having business meetings, and his energies are directly and indirectly making everything happen. So it's our experience that one man can manipulate energies in various ways. So it's not so difficult to assume that if you believe in a god, a personality who's a little bit more intelligent, he can manipulate energies in various ways, and he still remains a person. He doesn't, as Shankaracharya and the impersonal philosophers think, he doesn't lose his personality or lose himself in doing that. The founder of Amazon is still enjoying his life outside of his manipulated energies. It's illogical to assume that we have to lose our personality to manipulate energy. So I think it's getting late now. I would like to have said a lot more on the topic, but perhaps another time. So I'll pass you over to Hare Krishna.
Thank you so much. Very beautiful class, helping us to see Krishna in all aspects of life, especially this scientifical approach of Krishna's energies, his shaktis. Also, we heard in the beginning of the class, you made an overview of the topic of Chaitanya Charitamrita, glorifying also all our sampradaya, and a point that's always good to remember, how everyone is looking for that rasa, that taste in life. And then, yeah, the end of the class was very much focused on the scientifical view of Krishna consciousness. A phrase that you told that really stuck with me was, when you were mentioning the universities, you said subjective truths are taken as facts. And that, I feel, is a very crucial point.
Yeah.
And so then you went on explaining, especially I was listening, I was Googling and revising all these biology classes, how genes become amino acids and amino acids become proteins and how proteins are then managing our cellular body. So it was a review on biology class. I had a question in this regards. When you're mentioning the Darwin theory, in their foundation, Darwin says that in the pond, this pond, the chemicals, they see light, and then because of light, they react and they become alive. Is this correct?
That's what they don't say it directly, but that's what they mean, because Darwin's philosophy, they don't want to talk about abiogenesis, really. They want to talk about what happened afterwards. Yeah. But when you pin them down, that is what they really mean. Yeah.
So then the question came, what is our understanding, or what would you describe to be our understanding? How does that matter becomes alive?
Well, yes, matter becomes alive when consciousness enters it. You see, that's the thing. In our understanding of Krishna consciousness, we have matter and spirit. So you have to, knowledge means to understand matter and understand spirit. Professor James Torr, he always says that chemical elements, they don't look for life. They don't move in such ways that life is formed. It only happens when consciousness is involved. And actually, if you look up microbial intelligence, even microbes act in very intelligent ways. Yeah. And that's quite an interesting point, because people say, well, how can microbes be intelligent? They have no brains. But then we can get into the topic of what the brain is. The brain is the machine. It's the consciousness, really, that is running everything. So the point is that it's only because of consciousness that life moves, and not chemicals don't move as per se. They don't move in an intelligent way. They do react. If you put certain chemicals together, you'll get a chemical reaction. But even chemical reactions are not easy to synthesize. And if you look at chemistry, to try to build new compounds is not such a, it's a great science. Sometimes have a successful combination of chemicals, you may have 50 papers, 50 pages of what's to be done to make something bind together with such a way.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it basically is two different fields, like matter and spirit are two separate things. And then a point which science has still very much undiscovered, which is that aspect of consciousness. And that's still a secret in our modern science. So yeah, it's important is these are two fields.
Two fields.
So we have one more question. I understood the basics of this question. So this second question is in regards to the survival of the fetus. I will directly read it.
Yeah.
How can we use the theory of the survival of the fetus to our spiritual advancement? Although we are, and then it goes, there's a big description. Speaking about like how sometimes, I mean, it's difficult for me to summarize now. Although we are a communal society based on spiritual growth through mercy and blessings, how can this concept of self-competitiveness transform us and evoke spiritual fitness and in our pursuit for love, which is arranged through the feeling of separation? Like sometimes lovers may not tell they love each other to make that silence opportunity to grow and deepen our love. Is this a good understanding of applying the survival of the fetus theory to our spiritual understanding?
It's an interesting way. It's a very interesting way of looking at things. And I think it's we should be very, what's the word? Although we want to become the servant, still we must be very fixed and ambitious to perfect our spiritual lives. So it must be, I think that you could think that Rupa Goswami has said that one who, he is very, what's he saying now, very greedy. He's very greedy to hear topics of Krishna Katha. So perhaps we could say that in that sense, to perfect your spiritual life, you must have the greed to hear from sadhus. So yes, I think that in that sense, we could say the fittest will survive is the one who is the most greedy to hear Krishna Katha from sadhus who are relishing the topic. But that aspect is there, but also we have the aspect of our lives that to become the servant, the servant, the servant. And actually the greatest thing about ras and love is that we never feel that we've ever got it. So those that think they've acquired love, they haven't. But those who think they haven't got it, they might have it. Even Srimati Radharani thought like that herself when she met Krishna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Krishna was saying to her that, oh, I have done so bad, I have left you, and so I feel that I have got some fault there. And Radharani immediately said, no, there's no fault in you. If I had any love for you at all, I would not be living. So she took it like that. So sadhus themselves, although we have this eagerness to exchange love with Krishna, and we must hear from sadhus who exchange that love, in that sense we must be a bit like survival of the fittest in our spiritual sense. We must try to acquire something. But the mystery of spiritual life is that the more you have love, the less you think you have. So it's quite a mystery in that way.
Thank you so much, Prabhu.
Very good.
Very, very beautiful, very inspiring. We have a few minutes, and somebody's returning to the question of consciousness and matter. So as if you have a few minutes more, he's asking basically, how does consciousness influence matter?
Yes, interesting point. We can see that through, I don't know if anyone, even today in this life, we have what's called the two slits experiment in quantum physics. I think Kundalini Prabhu does something on that, and I've seen and read up something about that, that the scientific world, even today, if you look at the two slits experiment, it's kind of weird that when you look at something, when consciousness looks at this, light acts in a different way. So in quantum physics, this is quite an extraordinary event, not understood at all in today's world. And even the Copenhagen conclusion of quantum physics, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, accepts this concept of consciousness affecting matter. So we know it affects matter because of karmic exchanges, but even modern physicists accept this point through quantum physics. There's a great talk. So sometimes it gets a bit pseudo-science, but the basic point, even Niels Bohr, one of the founders of quantum physics, he accepted this point to some extent, that the classical world and the quantum world are two different worlds, and that the quantum world of many possibilities is there, and it gets affected. The classical world affects the quantum world by desire, by consciousness. So even it's quite interesting how the Vedic concept of consciousness affecting matter is even verified by scientists today. As such, the multi-dimensional universes. That's a very interesting concept that even today most modern physicists accept the string theory and all that. And there's one Harvard professor called Lisa Randall. She openly speaks. She's a Harvard professor right there in the middle of the university in America. And she openly speaks of multi-universes. I mean, that's straight out of the Vedas. So strange how the Vedic literatures speak about this multi-dimensional universe, you know, when Krishna lies down in the causal ocean, all these universes come in. And now in today's world, yes, it could be true. It could be true. So anyway, quantum physics is the way to look how that is basically a scientific way of seeing how matter or consciousness affects matter. Because if you see something, it acts in one way, and when you don't look at it, it acts in it. You know the two slits experiment, Prabhu?
Not exactly.
Then you should look it up online, the two slits experiment, and you can see that basically light waves or particles are waves. When you look at an experiment...
Oh, is the probability of the light particles to be in a particular spot? Is that the experiment?
If you look at them, they turn into... I think it's one of the ways... They're either waves or they're particles. Yeah. So when you look at them, they change. So yeah. This is a great mystery even today. Richard Feynman, a great scientist, Feynman, I think, he said that no one understands quantum physics, that they say they understand it, well, then they don't know what they're talking about. So this is the way consciousness affects matter, even today in today's scientific world. They'll accept that point as well.
Yeah. If we see waves, the perception of the consciousness of the perceptor is going to influence the object of perception, and a big fact that is still uncovered in scientific studies is how consciousness works. We have studied all outside of ourselves scientifically, but we have not studied our mind and our consciousness in a scientific way. So even though we study everything we observe, we have not studied the observer, which can influence everything because he is the zero from where we study all other subjects of science.
Perfect.
A great mystery in science.
Yes, and this point, that you put it so well, it's exactly the case. And of course, Sariputta Prabhu, a great scientific man, when he wrote many books on the topic, and he spoke about Maria Curie. She studied this matter. She was a prize winner, she was studying this phenomena as well.
Yes. Thank you, Prabhu. So our time is coming to an end. I'm sure everyone will take something home to reflect about.